Welcome everyone to Spotty Dog, our host for Malay Colony's October presentation of its artists and writers and composers from our 2009 season. Yay! Woo! My name is Calliope Nicholas. I'm the residency director at the Colony. And for those of you not familiar with Malay Colony, it has existed since 1973 as an international artist colony on the former estate of poet Edna St. Vincent Millay, who was the first female to win a Pulitzer Prize for poetry in 1923. For its 2009 season, Millay Colony received over 550 applications, and out of those, 48 writers and visual artists and composers were invited to stay with us. Those invited were given comfortable rooms, a private studio, a chef to cook their meals, and all of it within a beautiful setting. Malay's Colony mission is to provide support and freedom to those visiting artists to work and play in an unrestricted environment with no outside distraction. And the Colony is able to do that through our endowment, donations, fellowships, and sponsorships. Now, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our first writer, who was a resident here with us in 1991. Her published novels include Fat Girl Dances with Rocks, Martha Moody, and Venus of Chalk. She also has a collection of poetry and lyric essays titled Belly Songs. Please give a warm welcome to Susan Stenson from Northampton, Massachusetts.
Hi, it's really great to be here. I love the Malay Colony, I do. I had an amazing time, and I got a lot of great work done when I was here all those years ago. So I'm going to read the prologue to my novel in progress. I've finished a draft. It's called Spider in a Tree. And it's about the 18th century theologian and preacher, Jonathan Edwards. And, he's most famous for his sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, but he also wrote very passionately about religion as beauty, and he made people in Northampton sort of internationally famous at the time for their piety, and before they kicked him out after 23 years. So it's kind of Shakespearean, that story. And people who know me and know my work, and know that my first three books all four of them, centered on fat lesbians, sort of find it surprising that I took this leap to write about Calvinist religious history. But it was an impulse to grapple with religious fundamentalism from stories that I felt entitled to. And I feel like that tradition is part of me, and that it's important to try to understand that history and find language to tell the stories differently than they're being told now. So this includes quotes from prayer bids. There was a paper shortage, and so Jonathan Edwards wrote on scrap paper, and a lot of things are preserved that way that other ways would have been lost because people were saving his sermons, and so we get the bids that ordinary people brought in to him to read out loud from the pulpit, and also the receipt from the first time he bought a slave, which was a 14-year-old girl, in 1731 from a slave ship captain. So that's central to the story. It's not central to this piece. But something you might want to know if you don't is that a main image of the sinners in the hands from the angry God is God dangling sinners over the fires of hell like a person might dangle a spider over a fire and hearth. In Northampton, where long after his time, daughter Mary would worship on a chair outside the sanctuary so she wouldn't have to join the congregation, she took a boat across the river to Hadley for communion. They say that the Reverend Mr. Edwards wrote his sermons in a tree. He would climb the big elm in front of his house by boards nailed to the trunk and dangle his long, skinny legs off the limb. People peered up at him through leaves that sifted light, which he had taught them Even in the tree, he was aloof and somber, but passers-by craned their necks to enjoy the spectacle of him in his Geneva collar and second-best wig, writing furiously against a smooth place worn clean of bark. His inkpot was wedged in a knot, and when his elbow jostled branches, great arches of leaves shook. Jonathan Edwards ate from pewter plates, not wooden trenchers, which did not go unnoticed in the town. He was useless with an auger, and his wife was better than he was on one end of a two-man saw. But most people who passed by the house on King Street had felt the slam of his sermons truing their souls. They brought him plums, cups of chocolate, and prayer bids written on scraps for him to read aloud from the pulpit. He would lower a bucket and a rope to receive them as if dipping into a well. He came down for those in need of counsel. They would retire to his study, another place where he wrote long days and into the night. Among the learned, his sermons were tenderly, heatedly read. One breezy day, he was working in the tree, writing in a booklet made from scrap paper. He was only half conscious of reading fragments of old prayer bids on the backs as he turned the pages. Thomas Wells and his wife desire thanks may be given to God in the congregation for his goodness to her in childbed and making her the living mother of a living child. As he dipped his quill into the ink pot, a red ant reached the knee buckle of one leg of his breeches. Mr. Edwards brushed it away. The widow Southwell, being sick of a fever, desires the prayers of the congregation. A translucent yellow spider with light brown stripes rushed off the broadcloth of Mr. Edwards' shirt as if he were a pig to be conquered. As it neared his collar, he took up his pages and knocked it away. The spider landed on the ground, where it balled up and became almost invisible, a tuft of earth in the grass. After a time, it climbed the underside of one blade to the very tip and froze there, vibrating in the faint breeze. Mr. Edwards was looking in the other direction, upwards, as verses from Genesis rose in his mind. Suddenly, the spider lifted its abdomen and spun up to come towards him again, crossing a scraped root to begin to climb the tree. Mr. Lyman and his wife desire prayers for their Negro that is dangerously sick. It moved very quickly over lichen-covered bark to a mossy cleft strung with strands of web, flecks of seed pods, and small wings. It stopped on a tiny shelf of bark, went flat, then headed farther up into the folds, crevices, and smooth places where the tree had been skinned by fire. The spider skimmed higher, passing the creature without attracting his notice. It jumped and crossed a gap of sky left by broken limbs, leaving a thread behind it. Still looking up, Mr. Edwards witnessed a darting and tugging in the air. Samuel Wright and his wife desire the prayers of this congregation that God would sanctify his holy and afflicting hand to them in the taking away of their son, Samuel Wright, by death. They desire prayers that God would fit and prepare them for their great and last change. Mr. Edwards looked down at the blank side of the next page and began filling it again, unhearing and intent on his struggle to bring shadows into language while the spider preached a silent sermon from the web of the tree. Whatever your God would say of me, I am not damned. I did not turn to salt. Maybe that's because you never looked back to crack me into tiny crystals like Lot's wife. It's all dissolving in water, salt water, the blue part of the world's eye, the planet looking back at God who winks. You need me more than you've ever admitted. I'm still with you. I didn't perish. I didn't burn, although God dangled me over the fiery pit as you knew he would. He dangled me over the fire, but you observed spiders carefully once. Didn't you know that I would sail out of his hand as if taking great pleasure in the motion of my escape, spinning out trails behind me lighter than air might be? I'm a hunter, and I ate as I went. God was disappointed, of course, but he wasn't the least bit surprised. No birds or bats ate me, no toads, frogs, no reptiles of any kind. No tree limbs cracked and smashed me, no near stone fell. You were right. At the end of my life, I was swept on an insistent, crowded current of air with all the other insects in the sky above the sea. We came disguised in clouds, and we fell. I fell. You were right about all that, too. I fell into the water, light, brittle bodies dimpled the surface of waves all around me. I was washed over, lost my breath, and disintegrated, but I didn't die. God wasn't chasing me. He was busy burning sticks, watching the tips heat and color, wondering how long he dared let the flame go before he ground it out in his box of sand. I entered the deeps as something very heavy and very small. I sank without reason. I sank with abandon. I went down, losing everything but motion, gravity, my ability still to fall. I had no legs by then, no chance of swimming, no dream of correcting the course, no course at all. I was low, far under the roots and depths of everything I knew. Lost to God, although, of course, he could have found me if he hadn't still been playing in the fire, tilting dripping candles over his hand to see if it burn. I was falling, and he was waving his fingers in the air to cool, slipping perfect wax impressions from the tips. What happened then was that I tried to take a breath. No lungs. I landed. I fell, but I didn't burn. Slowly, Mr. Edwards became aware of a sound like many fingers rubbing together. He looked up at the rustling dome of leaves and saw meaning in it. Wind was a shadow of spirit. The world was as full of images of designed things as language was a full of words, but he found spiders hard to read. They were sagacious and hardworking, taking flights on glistening strings, but would devour each other like devils after the day of judgment if they were trapped and shut up without any flies. He took a note on the shape of the web. A dense scattering of gnats rose around him like spray from the great rippling waves of branches.
Thank you, Susan Stenson. It's fabulous. Our next resident is our October composer. His compositions have been published and played throughout the U.S. as well as in Australia. He is also a founding member of the Philadelphia Classical Guitar Trio, which has toured throughout the U.S. and internationally and has two CDs out on Latin American music. Please give a warm welcome to Thomas Smith from Millmont Park, Pennsylvania.
I'm very happy to be here in upstate New York. This is the first time I've ever done anything like this, a residency where I've had nothing to do but compose. Performing has been in my blood for a long time, and being a guitarist, I naturally do write for guitar. And as a matter of fact, I feel like I'm somewhat of an evangelist in terms of trying to add the guitar to the chamber music repertoire. Being from Philadelphia, I belong to an organization called the American Composers Forum, and there's different chapters around the country. Philadelphia has a chapter also. And one of the wonderful things that the Philadelphia chapter does is it sponsors a program called New Voices. And what New Voices is they ask for First of all, they line up a chamber ensemble that's willing to read and play the new music from their composers. And then they asked various composers, or composers from the Philadelphia area and from the chapter, to submit pieces for this chamber ensemble. If you're selected, then you have the honor of some very good musicians performing the music. I'd like to show you a little video here from June 27th in Philadelphia. Just give you a little background on the piece first. The chamber ensemble is called the Metal and Wood Band, and they are an outgrowth of the artistic director's full band, the Dolce Suono Ensemble. I think that went up, yeah, thank you. And the ensemble is a very sort of odd one, and I don't know if I'd ever write for it again. It is flute, guitar, which is right on my alley, viola, and double bass. This is, like I said, an outgrowth of one of Mimi Stillman, the artistic director's ensemble. She feels free to shrink and grow her ensemble when the need be. This concert, which happened on June 27th in the Unitarian Church on Chestnut Street in Philadelphia, I was one of seven composers that was there, and we were asked to give a little talk beforehand. I don't know if you want to hear that or not. It's only a couple minutes, but the music is next there. Are you going to play that for me? Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas Smith. Our next resident's work has appeared in several publications, including the Anthology of Political Poetry. She is currently at work in a novel titled The Holy City, Dream and the Traveler, which is a fictional narrative of the Iranian underworld. Please welcome Azarine Van de Blet Olumi from Sunnyside, New York.
I'm going to read an excerpt from the novel. It's about three quarters of the way in. So just some background information. It's a female narrator who sort of sets off on this journey by foot to the holy city. So she's sort of on a pilgrimage. And it's the piece has sort of this dream logic to it. So things just sort of connect in really subconscious ways or appear or manifest in really surreal ways. And at this stage, the only thing you really need to know is that she was in this blue town, and she was captured and thrown down a well. And by way of some sort of underground passages, she came to find this man who was digging a sort of old irrigation system, and asks him if he can sort of prop her up so she can get back onto the ground. And he says, "No, I can't do this for you." And she doesn't listen, so she sort of climbs her way up and finds out that she's landed in the town of only widowed men and is converted to a man. And she's carrying with her a baby that she was given much earlier in the piece by this man whose wife was taken into slavery and could not afford to get a wet nurse. So the whole piece is sort of inspired by a lot of 19th century Iranian folklore and superstition. And I've also been reading 1001 Nights, and it's uncanny because the way that it moves is really similar to the way this moves, and it's just the different ways that I guess culturally you learn to tell stories. It's just ingrained. So the language is really strange and kind of antiquated, so I apologize for that. But this is titled Entering Garden City, which is Shiraz in the south. So she keeps wanting to go north to the holy city, but all these misadventures keep pushing her south, more, further and further south. So entering Garden City, we came upon a person who very young insisted he was very old and requested from us to sell our opinions. As we approached the city of gardens, I dismounted my mule so as to walk a while and exercise my legs. But hardly had I touched both feet to the ground, the mule man protested, saying, "It is not wise to cross the place where one territory ends and another begins on two legs. You must be seated on a four-legged creature," he concluded. I thought to myself, my two legs are faster than the four legs of the mule, since the mule marched fearfully in a very undulating and slothful manner. But quickly I jumped back onto the animal and tucked away my desire. I did not want to test my luck, for it is easily tested when one is neither here nor there, between territories where there is nothing but lawlessness. Shortly thereafter, we came to a set of crossroads that made the shape of a starfish on the rolling hills. As we stood there contemplating which road to take, a very strange and slender person emerged from behind a cluster of trees. We saw that he had a pineapple in his hand, and that he was treating it as one would a ball made for child's play. He kept juggling the fruit, and when he tired of juggling, he passed the fruit from hand to hand by swinging his arms around his waist. I could see his eyes were rolling from side to side, and being that he seemed to me a madman, I could not make up my mind whether to focus on his eyes or his arms, which along with the pineapple were swinging around in great haste. We remained seated upon our mules, hostage to him, frozen from disbelief, until a moment later he began orating like a drunken and dejected poet, saying, "Death from old age is very near me, directly behind my head or near my ear, etc., very close indeed." Upon saying this, he fainted and fell over from laughter, and having returned to our senses, we traveled past his body that kept twitching and twirling like a worm struck by thunder. Some 500 meters down the hill, he appeared again, saying, "I am an old man. Have mercy on me." Although we could see that he was no older than 8 years of age. When we pointed out his real age to him, he detached his head from the rest of his body. And being that we were standing on top of a slope looking down into the city, he swung his arm back and, releasing his head, rolled it down the hill. A few minutes later, we arrived to the stub of a tree where his head had landed. Stupefied, we said to each other, "What should we do? Pick it up, bury it, etc." But as we were thinking this, the boy came up from behind us, appearing less in the form of a man and more in the form of a headless rooster running to and fro in search of its bloodied head. Then, calmly, and as though he had found a rare gem, he lifted his head from the ground and placed it back on. With his head in its proper place now, he looked at us and said, "Hand over your opinions, and I will put them in a boîte." He was convulsing from laughter, all the while his shoulders lifting into his ears like two sharp swords. Then, as though he had never been laughing, he said in a very serious tone, "Boîte is the French word for box," and very pleased with himself for being sophisticated in another language, he extended his hand out to us and said, "Thank you very much. That will cost you the price of 50 tomans. Now hand over the money or I will subject you to many more harassments." We were unsure whether the charge of 50 tomans was for his performance of the word boîte or for putting our opinions in a box, so that we had asked him which it was in order to buy time. And he replied, "No haste, no haste, no haste." And thinking that this was a creature with whom we should communicate by repeating things in threes, we said, "For what, for what, for what?" To which he replied very angrily, "Are you mocking me? Do not mock me thus." He was not a creature to leave us alone. Very irritated, the muleteer looked at me as though to say, "It is your fault for having dismounted the mule." Then, no longer able to contain himself, the words crawling up the walls of his lungs, he said, "Your wont to walk two-legged while we were neither here nor there has brought a non-mortal upon us." In a strike of lightning, I thought to ask the non-mortal a question. "What opinions do you want us to sell to you?" I asked. And he replied, "Those concerning power, religion, poverty, and war." But within a second, the muleteer had jumped upon him, and I thought, what old man is this that he is so agile to jump upon a strange creature? And in the time it took me to think this, which is to say the time of a few seconds, he had captured and tied up the non-mortal so that he was lying flat as a loaf of bread across the rear of the mule. As we descended into the city, he screamed and kicked, saying he was a state official and that we must abide with the system of concealment of opinions in relation to power, religion, poverty, war, etc., or else, he warned, going on and on. But as he kicked and screamed, he grew longer and longer on the back of the mule. Soon his legs were dragging on the ground, and his face as well, and where one second he looked like a loaf of bread, the next he was stretching like dough to the ends of the earth. We were like a dark cloud approaching the city, nothing like I had imagined us. When we arrived, two guards pushed open the city gates. They seemed to have glass eyes, because at the same time that they were looking at us, they were also looking beyond us, and did not take notice of the non-mortal who was stretching like a loaf of bread, talking of high ideas. I thought better to keep my ideas to myself and turned my thoughts to the landscape instead. Beyond the gates, there was a great wide river, which we followed into the center of the city. There, the river turned into a beautiful glassy pond that the muleteer referred to as a mirror reflecting the heavens. Then, after staring at the water a while, he said, "Below the reflections of the heavens is general earth, which is not the same thing as those parts of the earth converted into pools for the purpose of reflecting the heavens." I did not respond to him, nor did I fully understand his meaning, only thought to myself, what a strange man he is, for having taken me to the village of Mag, and for that what purpose, and now having captured a non-mortal who was quickly turning into bread.
Thanks. All right. Thank you, Azarine. Our third writer this month is also an alumna to the Malay Colony. This is her second residency with us. Her work has appeared in many publications, including BOM and Art Voice magazine. She has also been a writer for many nonprofits, including Meredith Monk and the New York City Ballet. She is currently working on a novella. Please give a warm welcome to Melissa Sandor from Buffalo, New York.
I'm going to sit.
It's okay. Thank you so much. I am reading from my work in progress tonight. It is a novella, as Calliope said, and it's actually a collection of short works that are an examination of memory and grief. There are a couple different components. Some are based on memoir, although I take a lot of liberties with the memoir, and so I'm going to read two pieces from that. The Iron. My mother ironed in categories, shirts, blouses, pants, sheets. We knew how to tell her mood from her ironing. Sometimes she would break into a smile as her right arm moved back and forth across the board. The television was usually on, a small black and white set that sat on the kitchen counter, and she ironed to soap operas in the early afternoon and Match Game at 4 p.m. If she was in a good mood, she might talk back to the characters on the guiding light or answer a contestant's question. There were other times when my mother ironed, her face sagging, her mouth in such a downturn that it looked as if it might drop right off of her chin. On those days, we would walk straight through the kitchen and to our rooms. I could feel the mistake in coming home too soon. Our house was not big enough to avoid my mother ironing. Her mood might show up in the volume of the piles of clothes, and every item got hung on its own wire hanger, except for the sheets and underwear that were carefully folded. My mother would stand behind the ironing board, doubling up the arms of long-sleeved shirts and pinching seams into pants as she pressed down with enough force for a slow steam to rise off of the board from her hands. Some days she even ironed my father's underwear, which she would hold up to us, the elastic band she stretched out in front of her, making fun of the size the way the bottom sagged. When she did that, I didn't know where to look, so I smiled, even though I felt suddenly out of place. If she was talking to the television when I came in from school, I would sit at the table with a snack and watch television with her. Sometimes we'd ask each other questions, or else I told her about my day. But if I walked in and she was staring down at the ironing board, I knew not to sit at the table. I would grab onto my backpack, hoping I could get through the kitchen quickly. On those darker days, the piles of clothes my mother ironed were three times as large, spread out across the room, draped over the kitchen table and covering the phone on the desk near the window. I could see our summer clothes in the piles, even though it was the middle of winter, and the clean sheets she had pulled out of the closet to rewash and iron. My mother stood behind her ironing board, its old silver metallic cover unraveling at the edges, while she stared down at a pant leg, pressing hard on the iron. We were never told what was wrong on those days, but I had been home from school with colds and sore throats enough times to know the ways in which the day would turn. Mornings began with my mother getting us breakfast and off to school, and my father out the door to work, running the broom around the kitchen floor and wiping up the counters. It was a letter or bill that came in the mail delivered to us in the afternoon that shifted the day. My father's oversight. The mail should have gone to a secret post office box. My mother didn't catch on right away. It took a while. The succession of letters congratulating them on increasing credit lines, notices threatening lapses in their insurance policies that my father claimed were paid, insisting that the check and bill must have crossed in the mail. Once my mother knew the signs, they disappeared, and then the phone calls began. My mother might be cleaning out the refrigerator, smelling the milk to see if it was still good, when she would answer the phone, then nod silently into the receiver as her face stiffened, reddened, her mouth cracked open. Her breathing would become heavy, a weight on her chest. The first time I saw this look on my mother's face, I went over to her as she stood in front of the open refrigerator. I hugged her hips, taking her away with me from whatever was on the other end of the phone. I only had to be pushed away once, tripping on the hem of my flannel nightgown and banging my backside into the edge of the counter to know not to do this again. I knew enough to take my tea and cinnamon toast that she had cut into fingers that morning and go to my room to read a book, preparing myself for when my father returned. Later, when I would come out of my room, my mother would be ironing. After my brother died, his girlfriend told me that he used to hide their iron under old bed sheets or in the cupboard near the microwave or behind his stacks of CDs. Once she found it in the bathtub with the shower curtain pulled shut. Some nights the sky. I might have been struggling to understand constellations night after night while my brother called up to the window on East 7th Street between Avenue A and B, overlooking Tompkins Square Park. He called to that window and the man would come down, meet him in the bar on the corner, and sell him enough heroin for the next few days. We all see different things when we look out of windows on tree-lined streets across from public parks where people walk dogs and play chess with mismatched pieces. When the man who sold my brother heroin looked out the window at my brother, he saw a man that he sold drugs to each week. I see my brother in photographs and videos. Dressed in his blue cape, he stood on the toy chest in our basement, smiling to the camera, moments before he would jump off, pretending he could fly, fall on the cement floor of the cellar, and break his arm in three places. In our old home movies on Christmas morning, my sister was dancing for the camera while my brother watched her from the corner of the frame. When my father focused in on my brother, he would stop, motionless, until my father zoomed back in on my sister. Most likely, the drug dealer's window was covered with grime from the city streets and an old bedspread to keep out the light so he could sleep undisturbed by the sun after he'd been up all night selling dope to people in the bar down the street. My brother left me waiting at the corner the one time I was with him when he went to score. He disappeared down the block for 21 minutes, and this was before the East Village clamored with NYU students, before Tompkins Square Park had flower beds and lit paths. 21 minutes, and I had the look that my parents had when I came home late, which wasn't often, terror that expands into rage the moment they see that you are safe. I could feel it cross my face, and I tried to get out of its way. I knew about slow death in the bathrooms of all-night diners and public parks and under the BQE from articles in the New York Times and reruns of Law & Order. I was an observer, and I was observing my brother. I saw it all in one gesture. My brother disappearing down East 7th Street at 9:30 one evening as we were on our way to play pool and drink a few beers. I stood there watching for 21 minutes. I looked down that block, which doesn't sound like a long time unless you are losing someone a little more with each passing moment and you know it before you have words for it, like heat in your stomach that anticipates something to come. And then he returned without explanation or apology, and we fell into step together and walked up to 2nd Avenue and then over to 11th Street to go into Dick's. Years later, I was stopped at a red light at the same corner. Dick's had been turned into a Polish restaurant. This was years after my brother hanged himself in his apartment less than a block away. We could see Dick's from his bedroom window. I felt again the coolness of the bar's air conditioner on that August evening, the cracked and torn leather from the bar stool against my thighs. The lights from the jukebox illuminated my brother's face as he pulled two quarters from his jeans pocket and handed them to me before he headed to the bathroom. I knew everything the way you do when you're losing someone with each passing moment. My brother disappeared down the hallway into the fluorescent lights. I imagined the chipped tile of the bathroom floor and the toilet he leaned over as he tapped to make the vein in his forearm pop, looking up once, looking around, even though he knew he was the only one in the bathroom, before he injected the needle to fix. I felt those two quarters stuck together from the moist heat of his hands and always the way he looked out for me. Thank you.
That was Melissa Sander. Thank you so much. The Lake Colony's next resident works in film arts, and his work includes portraiture, letter writing, and improvisation for his experimental narrative film. He is currently working on a film project of supernatural self-portraits. Please welcome Darren Floyd from Brooklyn, New York.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming. Nice to be here. Thanks for the introduction, and the opportunity to work at MLA is amazing. If you haven't taken advantage of it, you should. There's still time. Let's see. So I'm going to show you parts of three things. First, I'm going to show you a sample of my recently completed experimental narrative film that was recently screened at the Art Gallery Canada in New York City. This is just a two-minute sample of it. And actually, what's nice about this is the two-minute sample that I put together in my application for Malay. And since then, I've gotten into lots of other things because of the sample I put together for Malay.
Brayman and David Shannonbrook are pleased to announce the healthy birth of Joanna Lucy Brayman Shannonbrook.
Shot over 30 segments like this all over the country in different places each one, and this is just the first that I've been able to complete, and I'll be hopefully completing a few more in the next month here at Malay. Self-portrait of Fascism.
Let me think. What have I found? Have I found anything? I don't know what I found. I think I found a few days of maybe genuine happiness in LA. And since then, not much in the way of happiness anyway. Video letters mostly. And I decided to actually make one to Bob Dylan, who's really my dad. My better dad. My dream dad. Bob Dylan's my dream dad. And I should make one to Jean-Luc Godard. I should make one to I should make them to,
so it'll be hopefully 12 of those that'll run a loop. And they're all like that, like I'm somewhere sort of talking with that internal voice, saying things that you're embarrassed later to realize you said. But working on that project has really got me interested in self-portraiture. Like the way that project evolved was I shot it without really knowing what they were going to turn into. But having started to edit them and work through them, I started to get really interested in what is motion portraiture? How does it work? Like, who else has been working in motion portraiture and motion self-portraiture? And so right now I'm engaged in a kind of research project that hopefully will result in an open call for motion portraiture, because I'd like to see what there is out there that artists are making now. And as a result, I've gone to this stealth image that's been laying in front of us is actually from like one of the first reels of 16 millimeter film I ever shot back in the mid-90s. And this is what I did when I first got a film camera. Like, I didn't go try to be, I don't know who I could have tried to have been, but this is what I did instead. And so what you're seeing now is just about a 10-second loop of me as a younger man looking off to my left, and I've looped it back and forth so it sort of plays continuously. And I put this together earlier this year for a little show at an art gallery in the city, and I just had this playing infinitely, and I call it a self-portrait as a younger man. And here at Malay in the last few days, I've been using this self-portrait as a template to try to do some exploration in self-portraiture. So I just have a few stills here of things I've done since I got here to Malay. And the idea is that eventually these will also be motion portraits, but right now you just get a still because the animation's not complete. So this is a self-portrait as a Christian saint. I think self-portraiture is often vain, but then maybe sometimes a variety of
concludes tonight's presentation of our October residents. Thank you so much.
Go ahead. I have a question.
Yes.
I've seen a few of these. They've all been great. Can you describe an average day at LA for all the artists and writers and the buildings that have been there? Or a not so average day?
It's really funny. We kind of have a running joke in the administrative office between Executive Director Caroline Krumpacker and myself and Kara Benson, our program director, because we're there during the day, and we see the residents come in, and of course, with the first day they come in, we have an orientation and a dinner with them, and they're all exhausted from traveling. And then, you know, as the days go on, we can see them relaxing and getting into the flow, and around the middle of the month, they start frolicking through the fields. So it's really great. But we also have, but we leave. You know, we leave by the late afternoon, middle of the afternoon. So we come in the next morning, and we'll see things around, you know, the kitchen area and space. And there's a journal that they can fill out. And this year, I've been looking through, like, especially after they leave, whatever month that is. And it's filled with these images and these strange cut writings and drawings. So I actually have no idea what they do at night. Because they have the run of the place. So that might be better to someone. I mean, these guys just arrived here, actually, on Tuesday. So they're just now getting used to it. But, you know, basically a typical day is they have the breakfast, they have lunch, they can leave the studio whenever they want to. Do their work, go for walks, go out and see all the amazing things that are around, you know, culturally around the colony. And then they usually get together for dinner around 6:30. We have a chef who comes in and makes a meal. And then their evening starts as far as whatever they'd like to do, whether they socialize together or go back to the studios and work. Susan, you were here for a whole month.
I was. It's been a long time, but it was amazing. Lots of work. I was working on a novel and I was in an art studio, and so I could hang all the pages of my book all around me, so I was like walking into the book every morning, as opposed to my life having to accommodate my work. My work was my life for that month. And I was mentioning, I was here with Alice Siebel, and I could hear her through the other wall, like typing and sobbing. And we really got along, so it had that added element of somebody else who was a novelist, like writing as passionately as she could, and, you know, having like that unexpected, beautiful gift of a colleague. It's amazing.
And Melissa, this is your second residency.
And there is frolicking, definitely. It seems to happen. But I spend a lot of my days in the morning working in my studio, and then really look forward in the evenings to socializing. We often come together, most of the residents or whoever, sort of around people haven't taken off, and come together for a communal dinner, and we cook it for ourselves on the weekends. So it actually is a really wonderful time, and you're all saying, like, we were excited about tonight because now we've gotten to see each other's work. We'll be able to go back and talk to one another about that, and so I think the dinners are actually really special times, and you see who always, you know, remembers to bring a bottle of wine and and who likes to cook, and so that's a great part of it as well.
But again, you know, the one thing that we have, and this is a little bit different than some of the other artist colonies throughout the states, is that it's completely unrestricted as far as their time. They can work and accomplish as much as they want, or they can do nothing if they want. This is their time, and how rare is that for all of us? Mm-hmm. That we don't really, the cell phone service is very spotty up there. The internet service is in, you know, just one small place. And they have someone making their meals. They have a person comes in and cleans up the place once a week, and it's completely their own time. So there's really that gift. And what I have seen is a paradigm shift. From people going from their small studios and space to maybe where they are and having, you know, a day job, that type of thing, to coming to the colony with no time constraints at all. And they, all of a sudden, the creative, you know, starts bursting through, and they end up going into directions they had not expected they would go to and
go through. So it's really a gift for them that lasts quite a while after they leave the colony and go back to the real life. Any other questions or any questions for any of our writers or artists here? Great. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming. Thank you so much for all of that.
I'm sure that part of the culture is like, if you're in Hawaii, you have to go here and go